wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
That's great to hear. We're joined in studio here with, we've got Dr. Kushla McGovern and we've got Vihan as well. And we've got some very interesting topics to talk about today, which I'm very keen to get started on. This first one is about what might have caused, or what might have butterfly affected towards the Black Death. Obviously, it's not quite a direct correlation, but do you want to talk about this story that you've shared with us?
Yeah, no, this is a great story about, it's kind of the meeting of history and science, where it's not the history of science, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
It's so the Black Death, we know it as the Black Death or the plague, and it's basically, it was the single most deadly recorded pandemic in human history. So 1347 and spread from a few Italian port cities out across Europe and killed tens of millions of people.
Yeah, I remember learning about this in history class.
Yeah, you do, right? Because, you know, like, it's like, you know, there was a lot of misconceptions about what was spreading it and, you know, how it moved around Europe. I didn't realize this, but it eliminated more than half of the continent's population at the time.
Which, like, is crazy.
That's massive. Yeah. So what we do know is that there's this bacteria, Yersinia pestis, that causes the Black Death. Mm-hmm. So we know this. It's been studied a lot. There was, you know, there's been a lot of work around, you know, how it spread through Europe. But, like, how did it get there? Like, what was going on? Like, why did it start in 1347 out of these Italian cities?
Mm.
And so this is what this paper is about. What it's suggesting is actually this butterfly effect of, there was a volcanic eruption which caused cooling, which had an impact on grain, which had then imports of grain, also brought along this bacterium, Yersinia pestis, and we have the Black Death through Europe.
Yeah. So volcano leads to, the Black Death, which is crazy.
It is crazy. So where do you start trying to figure this out? So you look at trees. Which is, of course, what you first think of, right?
Naturally.
Like, let's go look at some trees. So in the in the Pyrenees Mountains in Spain, there's some trees living high up there. And so there are people who study trees and the growth rings of trees. So we learn as kids, right? You get these growth rings. They tell you how old the tree is. One other thing you can tell from these trees is, if you look at these growth rings, you can tell something about the temperature and the moisture of the time of in that year where that growth ring was laid down. So what they found in these some of these trees in the Pyrenees that they'd had these slabs from was, during the summers of 1345 and 1346, that it was probably cold because they didn't really grow very well. Like, the tree rings were kind of not what they would expect for good growth.
Yeah, okay.
And then they called them tree chronologies. So they looked at eight other spots around Europe where there was, like, obviously some slabs from these trees that they could study. And it was a similar thing. So, okay, Europe's was cold these couple of years. And so they're going, okay, well, this is just before the arrival of the Black Death. And I am using the term Italy here, but Italy didn't officially exist in the 1300s.
I didn't know that.
Italy as a nation is in the 1860s, but, you know, we're talking about that region of Europe.
Yeah,
so just
yeah.
for a bit of a shorthand.
The shoe or something.
Yeah.
The boot.
Yeah, the boot. Okay, so, okay, we've got this. Okay, there's a cold spell. Why do we have this cold spell then? So let's go now look at some ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica. And you can, with ice cores, it's kind of the, they have an idea of how fast the ice is being laid down. So you can work out kind of approximately in terms of distance, the age ranges of things. And you can look at the ice and the particulate and the air bubbles and all this sort of stuff. And you start to get a lot of information about what the atmosphere was like. And so looking at this for about this same time period of time, there's a lot of sulfur around. And so what this kind of implies is that there were probably some volcanic eruptions that put sulfur into the atmosphere, and what can happen then is that sulfur does a really nice job of blocking the sun and you get a colder climate.
Yeah, right.
And so what they were also able to do, obviously, because these are people who are very into their history, was they also look at historical accounts from, like, Japan and through to France, so from all around the world, and these kind of years have been reported as being unusually cloudy. So, okay, so we think, we don't know where these volcanic eruptions were, but pretty confident from this that there was these volcanic eruptions that then led to this cold
They would have had records of where it was, surely. It doesn't go unnoticed.
Well, I guess they might exist and they haven't been found or haven't been recognised yet. So now with this information, like, it might be that, you know, there's some PhD student in the basement of some library that's going to find this material and recognise what it is, right? Because it's also, you know, how it's written and there's all these... history's tricky. how does this lead to the Black Death then? We've got this cold summer. Well, obviously the grain didn't grow very well. If it's too cold, you know, you don't get a good food crop. So then there was a whole lot of other political stuff going on. So the area at the time was pretty good about having grain reserves, so it didn't run out straight away. But then it got to a point, okay, we've got to buy some grain in to feed the people. And they basically bought this grain from around the Black Sea area, and this is where they think the Black Death came in. Basically, there are some really spotty, sparse reports of the Mongol armies of the time in that area having Black Death or something looking like Black Death. And so they think what happened is actually the bacterium would rest, be in the grain, like live off the grain dust. It got into, came into Venice and Genoa initially, got onto the rat. The rats then transmitted to the humans, and the rest is
history.
So it just spread.
Whoa, that is crazy. Well, that's such a cool link that they've made through all of those events.
It is, right? That's to go insane. From trees to ice to, to bacteria.
A lot of science and history there, for sure. Our next topic is about this nanoscale chameleon-like skin, which looks kind of trippy. I was looking at the pictures of how they were trying to work this out. Do you want to talk about this one?
Yeah, so this is... I will caveat this. They haven't actually made it yet.
Right.
So it is all on the computer and designed and stuff, but it's still a really cool concept. And it starts with taking inspiration from something called kirigami, which I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, but quite similar to origami, though.
Exactly, right? So there's origami. It's just about folding the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Kirigami, you're actually allowed to cut the paper as well.
Yeah.
And so they must make, like, some... Well, they do make amazing three-dimensional structures and stuff. And so it's kind of... The scientists here have kind of taken inspiration from that, and they've basically designed this material that when you stretch it, it changes colour.
Mm.
And so this is kind of, we know in nature you get colour from either there's a chemical pigment that gives it colour or there's structure. So it's the way the surface is patterned, and it's on the nanoscale, so you don't see it by eye. And what these scientists have done is they've designed what's called a metamaterial. So this is just something that has really tiny structures all over it, like smaller than the thickness of your hair kind of thing. And if you pattern it in such a way, you can... basically design it so that it reflects certain wavelengths of light and doesn't reflect other wavelengths of light. So that's how you get your colour.
Yeah.
And so what they've been able to do with this thing is that if you stretch, on the computer, if you stretch this, you can basically change the wavelengths of light that are reflected from going from green to yellow to red. So the more you stretch it, the shifts to red.
Yeah. See, I was interested in that because I was wondering why it wasn't like the primary colors, like red, yellow, and blue, that could be reflected. Like, why is it those three colors specifically?
It'll be a continuum, probably. Mm. Like, so it won't go green, red. This is the middle one. Green, yellow, red.
Yeah.
It'll probably be like it's like some sort of continuum of color, so not instant. And it's basically because our visible spectrum is a continuum. It's not just those primary colors that we typically break down the colors to the primary ones, but it's a bit more complex than that. And so it's because these structures, it's all based on the gaps between the certain structures and the thickness and stuff. That's kind of why you'll it doesn't just break down to the primaries.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
I was wondering as well, like, what the, they mentioned that it's, like, chameleon-like. I was wondering if there was any, like, I have realized that I don't really understand how chameleons change their color either. Like, at all similar, or is that just, like, how they referenced it
How they've referenced it here. It's been a long time since I looked at how a chameleon's colored. I think a chameleon... this is based on very old memories and a bit of a guess. I think in the chameleon case, it's probably more of a p- pigmentary thing, but there may be a structural element to it, because often these systems end up mixed as well, so they don't rely on one or the other. But in this case, they're doing it more as a comparison.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, our last topic is about these alkaline-loving microbes, which might be able to help with like storing nuclear waste, which does seem like a big problem. Like the storage of, oh my gosh, that just sounds like a nightmare problem to have to deal with. But yeah, do you want to talk about this story?
Yeah, thankfully something we don't have to worry too much about in New Zealand
yeah,
at the moment, but if it becomes a problem overseas, we'll probably have to worry about it. So nuclear waste, one of the safest or best ways to deal with it is to bury it, basically. You put it in a container.
This is crazy. You bury your problem, like, deep underground. That's crazy.
It's kind of what the human race is good at, right? Let's just bury the problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you basically will put it in containers, and then it'll go in, like, tunnels and vaults that are basically surrounded in cement. And so the cement is basically just providing some structural support, sealing gaps, and encapsulating these waste containers.
Yeah.
And cement, you know, like, it's a material that we're very used to seeing around, but we also know that it does kind of crack, it breaks down, stuff happens. If it's underground, you've got a lot of groundwater, and so that can basically seep through it and react with it. And so you start to get cracks, and, you know, with the groundwater that's like seeping through it, it can become a bit corrosive and then weaken the nearby protective layers, which, you know, they use things like clay and stuff. And so, you know, there is the potential over time, hopefully over a very long time scale, that it will start to fail. So what can you do to maybe fix it in situ? So you don't want to pull it all out again, right? And so what these scientists have been doing is looking at something called microbially induced carbonate precipitation. And this is not a new idea. This is this idea of using bacteria that can basically, they eat, they produce carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide can react with calcium and magnesium that's around, which you do get in cement. And then it forms what's called calcium carbonate, or you might know it as calcite, or like limestones and stuff are calcium carbonates.
Yeah, right.
And it basically seals the gaps. So it heals itself. So it's called self-healing cement.
Yeah.
And it's actually a very old idea. So Roman concrete is lasted forever. And they weren't using necessarily bacteria, but they have, and it's only in the last couple of years they've kind of worked this out, is that they had like these basically chunks of lime, which is this calcium carbonate. And so what would happen is if you had cracks, the water would go in, this calcium carbonate would kind of leach and seal the cracks. And so this is kind of the biological idea of this. And so basically what these scientists did was they ran a 6-month study where they just had some slabs of concrete that's like of the sort of pH that you would encounter in these applications. And then they found these alkaline loving bacteria. They actually went to an acidic environment to find them, which was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And then they've basically made some groundwater, some fake groundwater. And what they did was they've just changed the amount of carbon in that groundwater, so the food source for the bacteria. And if you give the bacteria lots of food, it does very well. It produces a lot of carbonate, it seals the cracks, and it does a great job. But if there's not a lot of food around, of course, they don't do much. It's not going to work. So it was kind of more of just a study of showing, you know, like, this is maybe a viable concept. But, you know, you would have to consider kind of the environment around your, what do they call it? A geological disposal facility.
Yeah, of course. And does nuclear waste, like, have to be, like, stored like that for, how long does it have to, like, is it always forever?
Well, yeah, like, I can't remember what the half-life on a lot of the nuclear waste is, but it is a long time. Like, it's not, it's radioactive for a very long time.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy. Shout out to my brother, by the way, who's listening to the show. He loves Dear Science, I think, anyway. He listens to all of the episodes. But he asked if the bacteria can become super nuclear bacteria that could destroy the world, which is crazy.
What do you mean? Like, you do get the thing of, like, with exposure to radiation, like, you do get genetic changes.
So it actually could.
I don't know if they're going to take over the world.
About it, surely.
But if you think Chernobyl, right, where, you know, like, I mean, a lot of people know of it from the TV series and stuff now, but Chernobyl actually, and it's a great study in what happens to low level, not so low level, radiation over time. And so you can look at the frogs in the area, which are a lot darker than the same sort of frogs that are, you know, not too far away but not so exposed. And it's the melanin content has increased in the frogs, and they think it's a protective measure against the radioactivity. And there's lots of these little things and around there. So they definitely do get changes with exposure to radiation.
Interesting.
Let's hope they don't take over.
Yeah, I'm sure it won't be the main problem with that anyway. Sweet. Thank you. That's all of our topics today. Just a shout out to MOTAT. You can discover the forces that take you sky high, because on the 20th of December, so that's next week, the week after next week, just before Christmas anyway, Forces of Flight is going to be the newest Aviation Hall exhibition at MOTAT. So go down and check that out. I think they've also got the Christmas lights on at the moment. So that's another one there. Thank you, Kushla, for joining us today. Thank you, as always, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.